Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist and author Greg Palast, who discusses his six-month investigation into the threatened purge of 3 million mostly minority voters in 28 states, which could play a decisive role in deciding key contests that will determine control of the U.S. Senate. Catherine Culotan-Gonzalez of the Advancement Project, who takes a critical look at restrictive voting laws and suppression tactics employed in this year's midterm election. And Sam Jeweler of Public Citizen, who talks about a new report detailing the record amount of secret corporate cash funneled to candidates by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in the 2014 election campaign. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
At the 2013 U.S.-China Oil and Gas Industry Forum in South Xi'an, China, over 150 energy executives gathered to boost extraction of China's abundant shale natural resources. There was handshaking among the chiefs of U.S. energy giants such as Chevron, ConocoPhillips, and ExxonMobil. China is looking to move quickly into the fracking revolution in order to boost economic growth and find a domestic alternative to coal, which now supplies 70% of China's power needs. The British medical journal The Lancet reported that particulate matter produced by air pollution from cars and coal-fired plants killed over 1.2 million Chinese in 2010, a growing source of unrest in China. China currently has 200 experimental fracking wells and plans to expand rapidly. But fracking has already become a source of citizen protest, reports Mother Jones magazine, where a fracking rig explosion in the town of Jiaoxi in southwestern China in 2013 killed 8 workers. Water pollution and toxic air pollution are among the issues that have provoked growing complaints. While U.S. fracking regulations are considered weak by critics, in China the rules are practically non-existent. Xian Qinghua, an environmental researcher at the Sichuan Academy of Environmental Sciences, fears that fracking operations in China will repeat a pattern he's seen before. There's a phenomenon of pollute first, clean up later, he says. History is repeating itself. In late October, drivers for the new transportation company Uber turned off their smartphones in protest of low wages. The drivers, who work as contractors for Uber, a ride-sharing service, briefly refused to pick up passengers. Uber has become the target of worker anger in recent months as drivers' incomes have fallen due to a company-imposed 15% to 20% discount on fares during the summer and fall. Uber claimed that the fare cuts would boost ridership and drivers' incomes, but the fare cut left drivers making poverty wages. A crowd of Uber drivers and labor activists protested outside Uber's corporate offices in Santa Monica, California on October 22nd with signs reading, "Stop the War on Workers." Other rallies were held in San Francisco, New York, Chicago, and London. By operating in a regulatory gray zone, Uber is able to offer cheaper fares, in part by skirting the consumer and labor protections that bind traditional taxi companies. Cab drivers who believe Uber is undercutting their business have held several large protests against the company, including a multi-city European strike in June. According to the news magazine In These Times, labor activists are seeking to overturn the dynamics of the new so-called digital sharing economy, where people secure low-wage work through smartphone apps like Uber, TaskRabbit, and Airbnb. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul is among the top tier of likely 2016 Republican presidential candidates. Among leading Republicans, such as New Jersey's Chris Christie and Florida's Jeb Bush, Paul is the only candidate with a strong following among conservative millennials. Rand Paul, the son of libertarian icon Ron Paul, led a 2013 Senate anti-drone filibuster and decried the militarization of local police forces following protests in Ferguson, Missouri, triggered by the police killing of unarmed 18-year-old African-American Michael Brown. The Kentucky senator has also called for ending the federal war on drugs and abolishing federal mandatory minimum sentences. The drone filibuster and a lawsuit launched against the NSA's warrantless domestic surveillance program helped mobilize Paul's base among wealthy libertarian Silicon Valley funders and conservative millennials. But Paul, who advocates eliminating the departments of energy and education and privatizing Social Security, appeals mostly to white libertarian millennials, a minority among young voters. A Pew Research poll last spring found that only 30% of millennials favored smaller government, while 71% of non-white millennials supported the expansion of government programs and enhanced social services. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
A six-month investigation conducted by journalist and author Greg Palast for Al Jazeera America has uncovered a new method by which 28 states, mostly controlled by the Republican Party, have threatened to purge as many as 3 million predominantly minority voters from the voting rolls in the 2014 midterm election and beyond. Palast's report, titled Jim Crow Returns, examines something called the Interstate Cross-Check System, a project of right-wing Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach, who's known for his advocacy of restrictive voter ID laws and anti-immigrant legislation nationwide. State governments using the interstate cross-check system have compiled a list of nearly 7 million voters' names who officials claim have voted in two or more states during the same election, which is a felony crime. However, the list of suspect voters are determined by finding a simple match of first and last names in two or more states, disregarding different middle names, and with no apparent effort to filter out the vast majority of blameless individuals by using unique birth dates or social security numbers. When Palast requested copies of the voter purge list from these 28 states, only three responded: Georgia, Washington, and Virginia. Upon close examination, Palast found that Georgia's GOP had a list of 500,000 suspected double voters based solely on simple matches of first and last names from other states with no other corroborating evidence. Georgia's Democratic legislators were shocked to hear that they had not been informed about the state's plan to purge this large group of voters. Documents turned over to Palast by Virginia revealed that state government had already purged more than 41,000 voters on the dubious information supplied by the cross-check system. Your reporter spoke with Greg Palast, who summarizes the findings of his Jim Crow Returns investigation and the potential that the purge of millions of cross-check identified voters could play a decisive role in deciding key contests in the 2014 election that will determine control of the U.S. Senate.
The total list is 7 million names, and they say that's 3.5 million double voters. It's the biggest crime wave in American history if it's true. But it's not true. It's not a flawed list. It's not a bad list. As far as I could tell, there's not a single double voter on the list of 7 million. For Al Jazeera, the website and the television news there, I was able to get these lists. And, you know, typical, and I'm typical of the list, for example, are names like John Adam Smith voting in Virginia. And he's supposed to be the same person as John Larry Smith in Georgia. And that's a typical match. It's not just something I picked out to make it look bad. Literally 26%, that is almost 2 million of the supposed double voters are, in fact, have a mismatch or no match of middle name. Tens of thousands, probably a little over 100,000 names, have junior and senior mismatch. While they advertise as having Social Security numbers, the internal instructions which we obtained at Al Jazeera show that if there are Social Security numbers, and that's rare, if they don't match, and they never do, if they don't match, your name stays on the purge list. Middle names don't match, you're on the list. Junior, senior doesn't match, you're on the list, etc. There are no date of birth used to knock people out. If the date of birth doesn't match, hey, you're still on the list. That's why 27 states have 7 million names or 3.5 million supposed double voters.
Greg, your report says that Virginia has purged 41,000 voters as a result of this cross-check list. Do we know the numbers of voters in other states combined that no longer have the right to vote because of this dubious cross-check system?
Well, that's one of the problems, is that, again, remember, they wouldn't give us the list because they said that it's a criminal investigation. So they're playing another game. They're not telling us how many people are getting knocked off in other states. Only Virginia, which seemed to proudly announce that it had removed 41,000 voters from the voter rolls as alleged double voters. If you consider Virginia is typical, that's about 10% of their list. They said they're going to get more. They call it low-hanging fruit. And given that the list is pretty heavily racial, that's a pretty loaded statement. So if the other states are purging at the Virginia rate, you're looking at 750,000 to 1 million people are going to eventually altogether lose their vote because of this accusation that they're voting twice. So again, we're having elections which are being decided not by what the vote is, but who's blocking the vote. It's a secret purge. And that's one of the things that makes it insidious and most dangerous.
You've been doing some critical investigations of partisan voter purges since 2000,
yes.
Since that tumultuous 2000
yes.
presidential election. What's it going to take to correct this failed system of partisan voting that is now in full swing across so many states across the country?
The voters have to be upset about it. We have to decide as a nation that everyone has the right to vote and we will defend it no matter what that vote is. We now think it's very cute to knock out the opponents of voters. And they say, well, that's the rules. You know, and so this is a huge problem. And unfortunately, at the moment, most purges of that, especially racially based, are conducted by Republicans on a mass basis because they benefit when you knock out minorities, the usual targets of these purges. The problem is that Democrats have been doing it too. Not as effectively, not as well, but I've seen it all over the country. We have Hispanic Democrats knocking out Native American voters in New Mexico, for example. And so because all parties' hands are dirty, we can't expect the parties to take this on. You think, oh, well, the Democrats want to stop this because it'll stop Democrats from voting. No, no. They have their hands dirty in this. So it's we the people. And there are a lot of good organizations. Tonight I just spoke to Reverend Barber of the Moral Monday movement. He's filing a complaint. You have the Asian American Defense League looking at this because so many Asian Americans are affected by any purge involving common names, and they know why they've been targeted. 73% of Asian Americans vote Democratic. Again, it's partisan. But we'll only be able to end it when citizen organizations say, no, no, we all get to vote. Otherwise, it ain't America, it ain't democracy. No other way to do it.
That was investigative reporter Greg Pallast, author of the New York Times bestselling book, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. Find links to Pallast's Jim Crow Returns report by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As citizens across the U.S. cast ballots in the 2014 midterm election, 22 states, most of them controlled by the Republican Party, had passed a variety of laws that made it harder for specific groups of people to vote. The measures included a reduction in the days and hours of early voting, new obstacles placed on absentee ballots, making the registration of new voters more difficult, and imposing restrictive voter ID laws, which in Texas alone were estimated to prevent 600,000 citizens from voting. This avalanche of new voting restrictions followed the Supreme Court's 2013 ruling, which gutted a key section of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. While Republican lawmakers assert new limits on voting rights have been introduced to prevent voter fraud, independent analysis has found no evidence to support their claim. Civil liberties and civil rights groups have long charged that the drive to make voting more difficult disproportionately affects minority voters and is part of a strategy to gain partisan political advantage for the GOP. Laws designed to disenfranchise voters appear to also target college students, low-income voters, senior citizens, and legal immigrants who often vote for Democratic candidates. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Catherine Culleton-Gonzalez, senior attorney and director of voter protection for Advancement Project, a multiracial civil rights organization that works to achieve systemic change on issues of democracy, voting rights, and access to justice. Here she describes some of the restrictive voting laws her group has challenged through litigation and the coordination of community organizing leading up to and following the November 4th election.
I think that the number is about 22, and most of them are in states that used to be covered under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act under the federal preclearance. And so, you know, some prime examples are Texas, where there's actually a very strict unconstitutional voter ID law. That's where the court found intentional discrimination that the Supreme Court ruled could go into place. There's North Carolina, where we're litigating with the North Carolina NAACP. There are a number of measures that will be in place for the first time in this election. So the main things are cuts to early voting and cuts to out-of-precinct voting and cuts to same-day registration. And those are all things that help working people and help people of color quite a bit. And, you know, the state of North Carolina pretty much surgically removed them. So we're still in the middle of litigating that. In Virginia, there's a new photo ID law for the first time. There's photo ID laws in Mississippi and Alabama, also being implemented for the first time since the Supreme Court's decision last year striking down part of the Voting Rights Act. So those are just, you know, some examples. And there are some places where there have been improvements that we're, you know, very happy about, but, you know, quite a lot of attempted discrimination in voting this year.
I'm not sure how our voting culture got set up, but in many countries, Election Day is a holiday, or at least it's on a weekend when people aren't expected to be at work.
You know, our country is one of the few countries where we have a model that you would be, you know, expected to come to the polls on a Tuesday, on a working day, during limited hours. And so, you know, that model's really outdated. People, you know, don't have the kind of luxury of being able to take time off of work. And so weekend voting and early voting and other things have been, you know, really helpful to expand the franchise. And so when you take them away, it's a way of cutting back on things that people of color in particular have used in much greater numbers than, you know, their white counterparts. And also people who are poor have less ability, again, to get to the polls, you know, during a certain time. And we've also found when early voting is cut, it can lead to long lines. In 2012, the cuts to early voting led to exceedingly long lines in Florida. And so, well, people waited up to 18 hours to vote. Many people waited 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours, you know, just to vote. And so no matter who you are, that's pretty difficult. And if you're a person who's working two jobs and got childcare issues, that's even more difficult.
Is there any evidence that extending voting rights like same-day registration, voting by mail, and these other things actually increase turnout?
There's plenty of evidence that cutting these things, you know, has an impact on ability to vote. And the turnout issue is a really very hard question. In the African American community, people have fought so long and hard for their voting rights. And, you know, they remember Jim Crow. They remember their family members having gone through a lot to vote, or some are still around. You can still have a high turnout. You can still have people having to go through more hoops to vote. And that doesn't necessarily mean there's not discrimination. It just means that people are, you know, really willing to fight for their voting rights. And, you know, that's a broad generalization, but that's actually what we saw in 2012, that African-American turnout increased despite voter suppression. And we said that voter suppression backfired. So sometimes turnout isn't, you know, the only measure of if there's something wrong with our voting system.
What state would you say is the worst violator of voting rights?
It's really hard to tell. The worst one I know right now is actually Texas, because, like I said, a federal judge held, and actually it's twice, that their voter ID law was stopped by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. The Supreme Court took away that federal preclearance under Section 5, and so it was litigated again. And 600,000 registered voters do not have the kind of ID that will be required. And we know that there's a discriminatory impact and that the law was held to be unconstitutionally discriminatory. So, you know, with the rest of them, it's very hard to tell. We know that there's an impact on African-American and Latino voters in Wisconsin and in North Carolina. And the numbers are big, but the biggest numbers I know of right now are with voter ID, and Texas is, you know, the worst case right now. It's the first time in our country's history that I know of that the Supreme Court said it has been adjudicated as unconstitutional and a poll tax and intentionally discriminatory, but they're allowed to do it because it's too close to the election to change things.
After the election, what are your priorities for action leading up to the presidential election in 2016?
I know that in advancement projects, you know, everyone in the voter protection team is going to get together, and we're in about 8 states this year, and compare notes and, you know, look at the trends and figure out how to stop things before 2016. And I also would just point out that every year is important for voting rights too. So sometimes it's the small elections where these things could arise. And so there'll be, you know, elections in 2015 too. And you know, sometimes these local mayor races or city council races or things along those lines are things that we need to pay attention to, too. But, you know, our eyes are also on 2016, the types of voter suppression that we haven't been able to stop because they were just, you know, invented last year and the legal system's taking too long to stop them. We're going to keep on fighting and we're going to work to stop them before 2016.
That was Catherine Culleton Gonzalez, senior attorney with Advancement Project. Find more analysis of voter suppression tactics being employed nationwide by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Since the U.S. Supreme Court issued its 5-4 ruling in the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission case in January 2010, the floodgates of unlimited and unaccountable money have been pouring into U.S. political campaigns. Attempts made to pass congressional legislation to mitigate the effects of the high court ruling that supported the expansion of secret corporate campaign contributions in U.S. elections have thus far all failed. Therefore, it's not surprising to find that a record-breaking amount of money is being spent in this year's midterm election by so-called dark money groups, a class of nonprofits that are prohibited from coordinating with candidates and are not legally required to disclose their donors. These groups have provided the funds for more than half of all spending by outside groups in this year's most competitive U.S. Senate races. A new report from Public Citizen underscores the dominant role secret corporate campaign cash now plays in U.S. politics. The report titled The Dark Side of Citizens United found that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is the nation's biggest spender of undisclosed money in the 28 of 35 congressional campaigns it's involved in 2014. According to the analysis, the chamber has spent an average $908,000 per race, and nearly all the more than $32 million spent has gone to support Republicans or oppose Democratic candidates. Your reporter spoke with Sam Jeweler, communications officer with Public Citizen's U.S. Chamber Watch and author of the Dark Side Report. Here he discusses how the deregulation of campaign spending brought on by Citizens United threatens to disempower and discourage voters, making government less transparent and less accountable.
There's a huge explosion of dark money spending this campaign cycle, and it's being led by the Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber, as of the date that we looked at the numbers and is still true now, has spent approximately what the second and third place spenders have spent combined. It's spent, in the races that it's entered, it's averaged almost $1 million in each one. It's been the biggest dark money spender in 28 of the 35 races it's gotten into. And it's spending especially highly in Senate races. The Chamber has spent an average of $1.7 million per Senate race, and this was about a week ago, so these numbers will be higher now. Another important thing is that the Chamber has spent exclusively against Democrats. They have spent, there are a few different categories, but they've spent either to support Republicans or to attack Democrats. Early in the primary season, they did spend against some Republicans because they were trying to defeat Tea Party Republicans who they didn't think would be winnable in the general election. But the Chamber under Tom Donahue has become especially partisan and really just representative of the Republican Party and the pro-business, at all costs, pro-big business mentality.
Sam Jeweler, in the report, you talk about the pernicious effects of dark money, secret money, hiding the donors' names and their obvious self-interest in backing particular candidates. Discuss for us a bit what you see as the negative effects of this secret money flowing into these campaigns.
So basically in a democratic system, the people are supposed to hold the power and the elected officials are supposed to be accountable to the people. It's pretty straightforward. And there has to be a certain level of transparency there. We have to know who the elected officials are getting their money from, who is giving them resources to get into power. And the more undisclosed spending that happens in these races, the less accountability there is to the people, because we don't know who is paying for these ads. We don't know who is providing the resources, providing the money that candidates can use for staff. There's just not accountability when people are able to get into office and promise legislation to corporate entities and then receive funding for ads. And oftentimes these are dishonest ads that are not even elevating the public discourse. You know, they're often they're bringing it down. So often that causes people to tune out, to say, these ads aren't even talking about issues that are important to my life. And it just makes them very cynical. People have to understand the issues in order to make decisions. They have to understand what candidates actually stand for. Chamber is really leading the way and flooding the airwaves with misleading ads and just really obscuring who's holding the power and who's getting elected officials into office.
Short of a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, what can citizens do to push for legislation to ensure disclosure and transparency in campaign spending? Can anything be done?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there are things that we can do. You know, Public Citizen is also working on something called the Bright Lines Project, which is basically attempting to clarify what different tax-exempt groups are allowed to do. The Chamber is a tax-exempt group that's technically considered a social welfare group, and so it's supposed to spend less than 50% of its funds on political activity. But the lines get very blurry, and often the reality is different from what the laws seem to say or how certain people interpret the laws. So one thing that we've been pushing for is trying to get bright lines drawn, say these types of groups can do this and these other types of groups can do that. And I think it's important for people to take a step past seeing an ad on TV and try to learn a little bit more about who is running for office, and to really press on the city level and state level and the federal level for candidates to run without taking big corporate contributions and to really set an example. And it's a new thing and it's possible to do, but it takes engagement from people and really, you know, volunteering and saying, like, this is the kind of candidate we want and we're going to support that, we're going to donate, we're going to volunteer. And I think that this is a huge issue and it's hard to see how to overcome it, but, you know, after the election, there's a lot of work to do to organize our communities and to really express our power and pressure politicians to do the right thing, no matter who's in office.
That was Sam Jeweler, Communications Officer with Public Citizens U.S. Chamber Watch. Find links to the Dark Side of Citizens United report and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.